This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 19th of May 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated design show. I'm your host, Josh Fennett. A global design whirlwind of a show for you today as we bring you some of the best makers and most important shows from around the world. First to New York, where a design brand, The Future Perfect, shows off the wares of a well-known Dutch designer as part of the city's design week.
My designs are about the whole process and not about only the starting point or only a visual aspect. It's really creating a world in which there are possibilities and I try to take advantage of it.
Then we'll be meeting the winner of the prestigious Mies van der Rohe Prize for Contemporary Architecture in Barcelona.
All the shortlisted projects are not star architects, they're not so iconic either. And visiting them is really see them as environments. We really saw them at work.
All that to come and much more besides right here on Section D on Monocle 24. Now to start the show, we're going to New York and to the design concept store The Future Perfect. Last weekend, the brand brought Dutch designer Piet Hein Eyck's Wonder Room to its Manhattan showroom for New York Design Week. The original Wonder Room is a collaborative space on the top floor of Eyck's Eindhoven workshop. The exhibition is the first time the renowned designer has brought this aspect of his work overseas. The Wonder Room in New York showcases one-of-a-kind pieces made exclusively for The Future Perfect, as well as a few choice pieces from the designer's scrapwood collection. Eyck took Monocle's Megan Billings on a tour around the exhibition to chat about the concept and the designer's affinity for being resourceful with materials, both old and new.
The Wonder Room is like a big coincidence. The reason for it to create in Holland was that we had two floors of gallery space, which was very expensive to change each time, so we wanted to have less costs. And we had a lot of art after each exhibition, which we couldn't show in a proper way. So we made like a labyrinth in a big space of 500 square meters where if you walk around, you get confronted with art and objects and vintage and my own designs. And in this space, we actually created also a sort of living room with the sofas and a big kitchen. And this kitchen is quite professionally equipped. And then I thought, well, let's make a private dining of it. And David was one of the first to have one of the dinners. And he said to me, I want to have a Wonder Room in New York. So that's the reason why we're here.
Maybe you can walk me through some of the pieces. Particularly, I love the dining table, so maybe we can start there.
Okay. Well, the zinc table is, it might look quite different from the tables and the products we're known with the old wood. But all of the products are very much inspired by the materials and by the trying to be as efficient as possible, which is also necessary to have a possibility to make a sellable product. And in this case, it's made of zinc, which is has a very particular standard size. So the table is exactly adjusted to the size of the sheets we get in. The top is exactly one size, and the benches which belong to it are half of it. So we don't throw anything away, and that's with almost all products we make the starting point.
Let's talk about this piece.
It's a cupboard, and David saw it on the website because we have a huge website with an enormous amount of products we made previously. Not even everything, but a lot. This is made in a time where actually the waste tables were created, so the original versions. And we made also a series of discarded metal furniture. And we just welded together very roughly. In fact, the drawings or the designs are just line drawings. And by welding it in these lines, it becomes very banded and there's a lot of dents in it and a lot of colors. And everything you don't want in a design comes in. And in the end is the major theme in the design. Because if it's only a drawing, it doesn't have the rude surface and so on. And then we end up oiling it and burning it to protect it more or less against the rust. But it's a very nice way of producing. And it's funny that David selected a piece which we made like 10 years ago or something like that. So those bowls are from Floris Wibbe. We collaborated. And 1.5 years ago, I was at the Dutch Design Week and in his atelier. And we were talking about the machine he actually made to make faces at that moment. And we were talking, and while talking, we invented a new machine. So afterwards we created this machine, and the whole idea was to do it upside down from what he was doing. So instead of extruding, we have like a stamper getting into a cylinder, and by pushing it very hard, the clay comes up from under beneath. And then instead of using a machine, we decided to do it with a hammer, which is very funny because we have a huge hammer and a huge machine, and then you start hitting this machine with the hammer, and then slowly each time the clay comes a little bit off, and it feels very organic and very prehistoric. But it's the machine who actually creates this shape, and also the fact that it's each time different. So it's a collaboration between me and Floris, just because we had a conversation during the design week 1.5 years ago.
I'm just thinking about you being here in New York showing in the Future Perfect for the first time, and I'm wondering if it's inspiring you for future collaborations and what that might be.
Yeah, well, it's a really funny story what I'm going to tell now, because there's one guy I know for a long time, Diederik Krijfeld, I think, and he makes like art from pieces of wood, like portraits and so on. He called me just 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago that he was in New York, and that he found out that the water basins on top of the roofs are replaced once in the 30 years, and they throw away the wood. So he wanted to use the wood for his paintings, and he called me if I would like to use the wood for my work. So I said, yes, I like that. And I just talked with David, and we have the idea now to make like an exhibition with the wood from New York. I already had a design for a specific cupboard, but we want to make a whole collection of this wood, which is normally thrown away, and also with the art of Diederik, and then have a combination, and then have like an exhibition in 1 or 1.5 year from now on, with which is really New York inspired, but also the material comes from New York. So I've been photographing all the water basins on the roofs lately.
That might take you quite a while, actually.
Yeah, well, it's fun. What I was really amazed about is that they throw it away, because, you know, recuperation, when I started, it was not done at all. But at the moment, it's so normal to do it that I was surprised. So it would be very nice if the project would inspire people to do something with it, and also with other materials. And what I aim for is that we get one container, but that I make designs which will be actually produced in New York, or at least in the States, so that we export the ID instead of the product. So hopefully we'll be able to do that. And then it's, I think it will be good for everybody. It's a good thing.
That was Monocle's Megan Billings taking a tour of Piet Hein Eyck's Wonder Room exhibition at the New York design store The Future Perfect as part of the city's Design Week, which came to a close this week. You're listening to Section D with me, Josh Fennett. Now we head to sunny Barcelona for the biennial ceremony for the European Prize for Contemporary Architecture. This year, both prizes for the 2015 Mies van der Rohe Award went to Spanish studios. Our Madrid correspondent Liam Aldous was on hand to catch the emotions and reactions to the big announcement.
I'm at Le Caixa Forum at the foot of Barcelona's Montjuïc Hill, where some of Europe's best architects have gathered for the biennial Mies van der Rohe Prize. In a welcome move for this edition, the Foundation's director, Giovanna Carnevali, has opened up the jury's final deliberations to the public with a revealing conference on the eve of the announcement.
The day before the awards is the first time in the all the history prize that we asked to the jury to take the decision not at the end of the jury trip. So we wanted them to stay on hold, because only when you watch the projects in a very much detached way, maybe it's better also to take much more detached decisions somehow. This is open to the public. It's a way that public can live it. I hope that it's going to be more transparent in this way. Also because the public can really live also the doubts of the jury somehow. It was not easy. There was a moment in which I cannot say that they were fighting, but it's a discussion, yes, very high. Some crying sometimes, also even someone in it cried. But at the end, I mean, overall, it's a compact group. They are very complementary in that sense.
Head of the jury, Chino Zucchi, believes that the 2015 finalists strike a similar tone.
All the shortlisted projects are not very shiny, they're not, we say, star architects. They're not so iconic either. And visiting them is really see them as environments. We really saw them at work. So this ability to be a bowl. If people are the soup, architecture is a bowl. It should not mimic the soup. It just should make a good backdrop to our daily life.
The next morning, just before the big announcement, I catch the weary, tired-looking jury member Tony Chapman on the sidelines.
The debate did rage into the night. It was a good-natured rage, but it was a very hard-fought battle, shall we say. Of course, we come from different positions in architecture. We all have our own allegiances, if you like. But it was a Catholic list, and it's a fairly Catholic jury.
Are you happy with the result? Can you say that?
I'm happy that we have reached a decision, yes.
Okay, well, I'll touch base with you in a few minutes to find out who wins.
The winner of the Emerging Architect Prize 2015 is Louis Lushaus by Architectura G.
A few moments later, the award for Emerging Architect is given to a group of young Spanish architects from Architectura G for residence Casa Luz built in a small village in Spain's west. Aitor Fuentes speaks to me on behalf of the studio.
Those villages are getting empty. People are moving to cities or larger areas, so the houses are getting worse and worse. So there's one foundation who buys the houses really cheap, and then they sell them really cheap as well, but with one condition. You have to do a renovation to take care of the heritage of Extremadura. And Luz, our client, bought one house. She said, well, I want to do something here, but I'm on a short budget.
Do you think austerity in this case has become a European value to a war?
To be honest, I don't know. But maybe in the economical context we are now, maybe it's a value as well. I don't know.
And then the moment that this nervous room has been waiting for.
The winner of the European Union Prize, Miss Van der Rohe Award 2015, is Philharmonic Hall.
Designed by Spanish studio Barozzi Vega, the Szczecin Philharmonic Hall is the first building from Poland to be awarded the coveted prize. I catch Alberto Vega as he steps off the stage.
The most important thing in this building is try to filter through our eyes and through the idea of contemporary architecture that we have, that ambient and those things that we understood that were important in Szczecin. You can see reflections about the houses or the churches, but you can perceive the mood at the building that links with the mood of the city.
Yeah, this talk of how architecture affects the well-being of a city, the mood of the citizens, how tangible do you think that is?
You know, like architect, you just can do a background for that. What we have tried, like in a theater, to put the background and then to let people in, go inside and try to let that they can feel something. And I think that in this building they can feel. For example, it was surprising to see the attitude when the people comes in, because the entrance is a very low space. Then when they come in, they do something like breath, because the space is huge. Szczecin is a city at the northwest part of the country. It's far from every point of Poland. And suddenly the building focused some attention about the city. And now I feel in that way they feel a little bit proud.
That was Monocle's Madrid correspondent Liam Aldous bringing us that report from the 2015 Mies van der Rohe Award Ceremony, which took place earlier this month in Barcelona. This is Section D on Monocle 24, and we'll be back after this.
Monocle Films explores the art of a warm welcome with Fabrica's design team to celebrate a special collaboration with Airbnb at the Palazzo Crespi in Milan.
Traveling is like life, and it's about the way we put things together, and slowly, slowly, if you cook it well, it can become something. And then you rearrange it, you design it.
Housewarming, design ingredients for a welcoming experience. Now playing in the film section of Monocle.com.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24 with me, Josh Fennett. Now we turn to the port city of Hamburg in northern Germany. Some cities have a recognisable urban vernacular, an architectural style or building material that marks an attitude, aesthetic, or perhaps the vision of its historical city planners. in Hamburg, one of the primary markers are the city's beautiful red brick buildings. Our Berlin correspondent, Kimberly Bradley, a former Hamburg resident herself, headed back to the Hanseatic city to investigate the material's history and continued presence.
Anyone who's spent time in Germany knows that natives like to look for the roten Faden, the red thread or recurrent theme that connects a train of thought, a conversation, a story. When considering Hamburg's architectural history, the red thread is literally red, as in a deep red brick. The many buildings made with red bricks and clinkers, which are bricks fired so hot that they vitrify, creating dense units that clink when hit, could be considered Hamburg's vernacular architecture. Their facades paint maroon and rust stripes through the city, in municipal buildings, neo-Gothic warehouses, modernist housing projects, and now even in Hamburg's massive urban expansion, the Hafen City. The material dates to the city's origins in the 1200s. It was durable, it was available, and the red correlates to high iron content in the native soil. Later, in the late 1800s, when the city was booming, its Speicherstadt, which is the harbor warehouse district, was erected in red brick neo-Gothic turrets, towers, and vertical lines. But Hamburg's signature style got its biggest push when architect and urban planner Fritz Schumacher became Hamburg building director in 1909 and branded the hometown material as a way to future urban living. "I admire the Gothic style," the architect wrote, "but my efforts are to give new life to the movement for red brick out of the material itself. An architectural language will be developed that will be characteristic of Hamburg's individuality and at the same time useful for modern urban needs." Schumacher erected public buildings, schools, and housing estates like Jahrestadt with increasingly modernist features like horizontal bands of windows. He also delegated to colleagues like Fritz Hüger, whose Chile House is one of Hamburg's best-known architectural landmarks. Or Hans or Oskar Gerson, who with Hüger built the imposing Splinkenhof office building, not far from the even larger Brahms Kontorhaus, which was built from 1904 to 1931. The red came to represent Hamburg's independence, its left-leaning bent, and modernity. Sadly, Schumacher's utopian vision was promptly truncated by the Nazis, who threw the far too liberal urban planner out in the early 1930s. But the look was set, and Hamburg's brickwork has amazingly carried on through the decades. Later structures like the Hanseviertel Shopping Center, built by Gerkan Marg and partner in the late 70s, are a continuation of this tradition. In the 1980s, Hamburg's building director Egbert Kossak mandated red brick, creating a backlash in glass in the 1990s. But newer developments again see a return to tradition. Buildings like the Holzhafen on the Elbe and the Ecumenical Forum in the Hafen City directly quote the past. From some vantage points in the stormy Hafen City, the shades of red and ochre beautifully, almost hauntingly overlap. Their tenacity is a testament to another important red thread that's run for centuries through this city-state that's built on independence, free trade, and lots of rough salt water and wind. That's practicality. Hamburgers famously remember the bottom line. Red bricks are a perfect material for the Hanseatic mentality, since they, like the people who live in them, can withstand it all.
That was Monocle correspondent Kimberly Bradley reflecting on the importance of the brick in Hamburg's architectural identity. And you can read and see much more on the matter in the design directory within the May issue of Monocle magazine, which is on newsstands now. This is Section D with me, Josh Fennett. At the end of April, a terrible earthquake struck Nepal and a second deadly quake struck only last week. As attention shifts from the immediate humanitarian crisis, talk is turning to the massive challenge of rebuilding and restoring Nepal's great heritage and civic structures. In 2010, after an earthquake devastated much of Haiti, including its capital, Port-au-Prince, rebuilding the iconic central market of the city became a top priority. The reason was simple but poignant. The iron market's restoration represented the strength and resilience of Haiti's people and a first step towards the country's recovery. The reconstruction project in Haiti was spearheaded by London-based architecture practice John McCaslin and Partners. Monocle's producer David Pleasant stopped by its studios and sat down with the executive chairman and founder John McCaslin to discuss the importance of rebuilding and the design challenges it poses.
The iron market has always been a key building in Port-au-Prince and a much-loved building. It was a market hall that had been built in 1891, employed thousands of people either directly or indirectly, and was the centre of trading and market life in the capital. In a way, one of the key things that allowed us to move fairly quickly was the fact that we had a sponsor for the project, a guy called Dennis O'Brien, who is one of the leading employers in Haiti. He runs a company called Digicel, communications company, and he was a kind of classic patron philanthropist who immediately stepped forward and committed to funding the project. So in a way, having the funds in place to do the project dealt with one of the main hurdles, that is getting funding. I suppose the other key problem associated was actually just finding the materials to rebuild it, and we took all sorts of shortcuts to make that happen. We got a steel manufacturer from the States to produce the steel and to get it shipped and ease its way through the kind of port system to get that on site. And we also employed about 750 local artisans who were obviously desperately looking for work to do a lot of the repair work and indeed a lot of the decorative metal work. So there were people looking for work, desperately looking for work. There was a funder in place with Dennis O'Brien, and I think a team of people, you know, led by ourselves, I guess, who were committed to seeing this building restored within 1 year of the earthquake.
If we kind of jump forward a little bit and look at what's just happened in Nepal, the kind of terrible loss or damage to heritage buildings there, do you think there's any sort of comparisons that can be made, for instance?
You know, it's obviously tragic but timely to compare Haiti and Nepal. You know, there are various stages in an earthquake, and the first, of course, is to save as many lives as you possibly can, and the second is then to stabilise what's left, and the third is to obviously rehouse and try to get the country back in some sort of functioning way. If there is then a rebuilding effort that requires architects who have skills or who are able to support that endeavour, then, of course, I think that's the appropriate time to step forward. I mean, in a way, in Haiti, we were there quickly because we were already very familiar with the country and we were very familiar with that building. And we had a client who really wanted to move things very quickly and to use the Iron Market as a sort of symbol of hope, you know, in what is one of the poorest countries in the Western Hemisphere.
That kind of dichotomy between housing people, you've stated very clearly the importance of doing that, over perhaps looking at very important buildings within a city or a culture. How do you justify that, basically? How do you kind of look at a building like the Market Building and sort of value its importance to a community? I mean, if there is the problem of housing and so on, what kinds of arguments can you put forward as an architect? I mean, is it a challenge or do you think it's patently obvious?
That's a very good question. It's where do you decide to make a contribution? If you look at the simple facts in Haiti, the earthquake caused about $10 billion of damage. So that's a huge project, so the cost of building Terminal 5 or something. And whilst rehousing and new schools and new hospitals are, of course, incredibly important and more important than rebuilding the iron market, for a moment I wouldn't argue with that. I think in terms of pure straightforwardness of a project that would be symbolic and that we knew would be finished because it was fully funded and didn't require complex issues of land tenure or international funding. In a way, it was a project that one could have done in here or in Dublin or anywhere else. It was a very simple piece of reconstruction in relative terms. The only complexity was that the ownership of the land was the city's, but they authorised the restoration and that the heritage groups there authorised the restoration. So I think it was, from purely kind of pragmatic point of view and a sort of symbolic representation of hope for the future, the Iron Market was a great success and achieved everything we could have hoped it could have achieved. But in relative terms, I absolutely agree that, you know, to have rehoused people in permanent safe housing is a more important, more significant and more challenging project, which remains indeed extremely challenging in Haiti and as it has in other post-earthquake areas.
That was, of course, Section D's producer, David Pleasant, speaking to John McCaslin, lead architect in the rebuilding of Port-au-Prince's iron market in Haiti. And we end the show with a spot of shopping. Manchester-based menswear shop Oi Polloi is an icon of contemporary northern style in the UK. Founded 12 years ago, the brand has opened its first retail space outside of its native city on Marshall Street in London, Soho. Stocking all 40 brands found in its Manchester flagship, the shop looks set to expand the brand's reach to loyal customers down south in the British capital. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco paid a visit and spoke to Oi Polloi's co-founder, Steve Sanderson.
Well, it's a strange feeling sort of bringing what we've created in Manchester down to London. I think one of the big things that we've done over the last few years is the internet, and the internet has shown us that the kind of people wanting the clothes that we sell is a bigger, much wider audience. A lot of people in London are some of our best customers, so we figured it was about time we came down and opened a shop and showed them what the real thing looked like, not a digital sort of version.
But do you still feel Epoloy represents the Manchester fashion scene or the city itself?
I don't think it does. We can't help where you sort of grow up, the influences that you come into contact with. That is going to inform the kind of things that you're into. I feel that the kind of things that we've been buying and selling over the last sort of 13 years are basically just a reflection of a mixture of functional outdoor gear, classic sort of menswear, and then contemporary cutting edge kind of menswear as well. So I think it's a mixture. I think it's more of a global thing these days.
And about the brands you're selling, what's kind of the main difference between here and the one in Manchester? Is it kind of the same products, or are you doing kind of a curated selection of your Manchester products as well?
It is a curated selection of the brands that we sell. We've tried to focus on what we think is a good representation of what Epoloy is about, but also thinking along the lines of we've got to make a commercial shop as well. So we've edited down what we do. We've got about 40 odd brands in this store, and that's across all different sort of categories and stuff. But I think in Manchester, it's more like 100. So it's quite a tight edit on what we do. And it's more to try and find what works in this sort of local kind of area and the type of customers that we're attracting. So we're just trying to find our feet. I mean, we're only 2 weeks in, and it's quite funny because some of our better brands are already selling better than anything else, which is really quite interesting.
So I see you selected a few products, some of your highlights. Can you go through them with me?
I picked a t-shirt from a company, which is a Korean label called Custom Mellow. It's basically like an oversized toweling t-shirt, navy and white. It's kind of a little bit Paul Weller sort of Style Council kind of era when he was pretty sort of fly. Then team that with some just off-white jeans by a company called Anatomica, which is a Parisian-based label. But now the jeans are all sort of made in Japan. The thing that's pretty interesting about these, it's like an old 501 type shape. So it's not boot cut, but it's a straight leg, so it appears a little bit like that. And it's got a slight bow to it as well, but there's no outside seam, so they're pretty interesting shape and cut. The guy that actually makes them is the same guy that produces Rocky Mountain Featherbed and a few other really good sort of Japanese labels, so he knows what he's doing. Over the top of that, for your jacket, I'm going to pick an Oslo, just off-white denim jacket, trucker jacket. Again, amazing Japanese label run by a mad denim head, denim collector. I'm actually wearing one of these jackets today. It's a corduroy version of the same thing. And then some ecru, sort of just off-white canvas pumps by a company called Nivesta.
That was Monocle's fashion forward, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, visiting the newly opened London premises of menswear retailer Epoloy. And sadly, that's all we have time for on this episode of Section D with me, Josh Bennett. Today's show was produced by David Pleasant and edited by Alex Funnell. You can contact the producer, David, at dmp@monocle.com with any comments or questions. That's all for this week. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.